I'm glad to see everybody. I was thinking that the afternoon of the last day of the lectureship, there'd be three or four of you here. But we did better than that. But thank you for coming. I'm delighted to see you. I realized yesterday that I made a tactical error in how I planned this, because at the chapel on Monday, I introduced the new atheism. And then a brother came up to me yesterday after I'd done the first class assuming the introduction, and he said, "Would you say something about basically who the new atheists are?" And I said, "Well, I talked about that in chapel." He said, "Yeah, but we weren't there." I said, "Okay." So anyway, I've been assuming a lot of that. All I can say, I only have time to say about the new atheists, is they're a new breed of atheists that arose in the aftermath of the religiously motivated attacks on America on September 11, 2001. And you had some guys write books attacking people's belief in God. And basically, their distinguishing feature is, you've had atheists forever, but their distinguishing feature is their intolerance of and hostility toward religion. And what I'm doing in my classes, a major theme, by the way, my name is Ashby Camp. I ought to say that for the recording. But a major theme of the new atheist is that Christianity, like all religions, gets people to believe fantasies, things they have absolutely no reason to believe are true. And in my three classes, I'm refuting that specific charge, that there is no rational basis for believing God exists, no evidence from which a person could reasonably conclude God exists. And in the first class, I argued that it's more reasonable to believe that the universe was brought into existence by something than to believe it was not. And it's more reasonable to believe that that cause or something was a timeless, non-physical, and immensely powerful personal being than to believe it was not. And in the second class, I argued that it is more reasonable to believe there is an objective moral standard than to believe there is not. And it is more reasonable to believe that an objective moral standard cannot exist without God than to believe it can. Now, this class, my contention here is it's more reasonable to believe that free will exists than to believe it does not. And it's more reasonable to believe that free will can't exist without God than to believe it can. Now, as always, I'm concerned about time. If you've been in any of my classes, I've gone over the last two. I'm going to try better. I'm going to try to actually cut this. I'm used to a bell ringing. Either I'm too deaf to hear the bell or it hasn't rung. But I'll try to be more tuned into that. But if you'll just let me get through the material that I've presented, I would appreciate that. But I do encourage you to check out that website. It's theoutlet.us. It has many things on it. It has the notes for these, Answering the New Atheism. I forget how many pages. I think it's 90, 70, I don't remember. But I deal with a lot more than simply the three things I have extracted from it to talk to you about. And then I have many other writings on many other topics. If you find any of it there worthwhile, I'd be delighted if you'd share it with other people. All right, so the contention here, it's more reasonable to believe that free will exists than to believe it does not, and it's more reasonable to believe that free will cannot exist without God than to believe it can. I mean, humans are able to think and act in a genuinely non-determined manner. We can choose to write a letter, eat an apple, sing a song, say, "Boy." We can choose to do any of these things, or we can choose not to do those things. Now, if there's no God, then the universe and everything in it is the result of physical laws, and there are various physical laws. You've got gravitational, electromagnetic, you've got chemical, mechanical, thermodynamic, radiation. You have various laws. But if there is no God, then everything, universe and everything in it, is the result of physical laws acting on matter and energy over time, which is an exclusively deterministic process. In other words, things occur solely because the laws of nature dictate that they occur. And the question is how this strictly deterministic process could give rise to beings that act in a non-determined manner. I mean, what's the evidence that that physical laws can create free will? That physical laws can create a state in which beings act in a way that is not determined by those laws? Where is the evidence that laws can release things from their control? And this is a problem. This is a problem for the materialistic worldview. The philosopher J.P. Moreland, he says, you can't get something from nothing. It's as simple as that. If there were no God, then the history of the entire universe up until the appearance of living creatures would be a history of dead matter with no consciousness. You would not have any thoughts, beliefs, feelings, sensations, free actions, choices, or purposes. There would be simply one physical event after another physical event behaving according to the laws of physics and chemistry. How then do you get something totally different? Conscious, living, thinking, feeling, believing creatures from materials that don't have that. That's getting something from nothing. And that's the main problem. However, if you begin with an infinite mind, then you can explain how finite minds could come into existence. That makes sense. What doesn't make sense, and which many atheistic evolutionists are conceding, is the idea of getting a mind to squirt into existence by starting with brute, dead, mindless matter. So do you see the gap? How do you get from a state that is purely deterministic, physical laws, into an existence in a state that has beings that act not determined by physical laws? So you have this gap and this problem, and there is no good explanation for how you do that. So then what does that leave the atheist in a position of doing? Well, then the atheist then does what? Insists that your free will is an illusion. Okay? Now, you saw that with objective morality. Same problem they get caught up in. Then what is it? Well, objective morality is an illusion fobbed off on us by our genes. Okay? So now I'm talking about free will. You say, yeah, I see that problem of getting there from brute dead stuff into this state where you have beings that act in a way not determined by those laws. Yeah, that is a big hurdle. But fortunately for us, we don't have to clear it because free will is an illusion. This idea that human choices and conduct, that you have free will, you don't. Human choices, human conduct are in fact determined by physical laws and effects. Physical laws and those things. It's determined, and the effects of those things are just too complex for us to trace out. But trust me, they're all determined. In the words of the prominent, the best known, I'd say the most highly regarded atheist philosopher of the 20th century, Bertrand Russell, he says, man's hopes and fears, his loves and his beliefs are but the outcome of accidental collocations, accidental arrangements of atoms. In his 1994 book, The Astonishing Hypothesis, The Scientific Search for the Soul, Francis Crick, who's the co-discoverer of DNA, Francis Crick proclaimed, the astonishing hypothesis is that you, your joys and your sorrows, your memories and your ambitions, your sense of personal identity and free will are in fact no more than the behavior of a vast assembly of nerve cells and their associated molecules. Dawkins wrote in 1995, DNA neither cares nor knows. DNA just is, and we dance to its tune. We dance to its music. Will Provine. Provine was an atheistic historian of science at Cornell University. And in the abstract to his comments that were delivered at the second annual Darwin Day celebration at the University of Tennessee, that abstract begins with this. Naturalistic evolution has clear consequences that Charles Darwin understood perfectly. No gods worth having exist. No life after death exists. No ultimate foundation for ethics exists. No ultimate meaning in life exists. And human free will is non-existent. Anthony Cashmore, who's a biologist at the University of Pennsylvania, he argued in an article published in 2010. He says, the reality is, not only do we have no more free will than a fly or a bacterium, in actuality, we have no more free will than a bowl of sugar. The laws of nature are uniform throughout, and these laws do not accommodate the concept of free will. Okay, so you see they recognize the difficulty. They recognize there is no good explanation from going from here to there. So the answer is there doesn't exist. There is an illusion that you are sucked into believing by all of these materialistic explanations. And so you can see that. This is, there are many people. The late theoretical physicist Stephen Hawking, he wrote in a book co-authored with L. Mladenow, The Grand Design. Hawking says, it's hard to imagine how free will can operate if our behavior is determined by physical law. Indeed it is. If you're going to say everything's deterministic, well then yeah. It is hard to say how free will can exist. He says, hard to imagine how free will can operate if our behavior is determined by physical law. So it seems we are no more than biological machines and that free will is just an illusion. Alex Rosenberg, I mentioned him before. He's the R. Taylor Cole Professor of Philosophy at Duke University. He wrote in his book, The Atheist's Guide to Reality, everyone seems to know what life's persistent questions are. This book aims to provide the correct answers to most of the persistent questions. Here's a list of some of the questions and their short answers. Is there a God? No. What is the nature of reality? What physics says it is? Is there free will? Not a chance. Not a chance. There can't be in this atheistic universe under that idea. Graham Lawton, he's the editor of New Scientist magazine. He wrote, certainly not a creationist publication. He's the editor of New Scientist magazine, and Lawton wrote in November of 2001, so what of free will? The problem's a familiar one. We live in a deterministic universe. Well, if you are an atheist, of course you do, because that's the only explanation you have. Everything is the outworking of physical laws acting on matter and energy over time. That's it. That's all you got. So of course you live in a deterministic universe. Given enough information about its present state, we could extrapolate to any past or future state with 100% accuracy. Everything that has or will happen was determined at the Big Bang, and given that our brains are part of the physical universe, free will does not exist. Jerry Coyne, he's a biology professor, raving atheist, biology professor at the University of Chicago. Coyne wrote in January of 2012, perhaps you've chosen to read this essay after scanning other articles on this website. Or if you're in a hotel, maybe you've decided what to order for breakfast or what clothes you'll wear today. You haven't. You may feel like you've made choices, but in reality, your decision to read this piece and whether to have eggs or pancakes was determined long before you were aware of it, perhaps even before you woke up today. And your, quote, will had no part in that decision. So it is with all of our other choices. Not one of them results from a free and conscious decision on our part. There is no freedom of choice, no free will. And those New Year's resolutions you made, now this may be comforting to some of us, but he said, you had no choice about making them. And you'll have no choice about whether you keep them. True, quote, free will then would require us to somehow step outside of our brain's structure and modify how it works. Do you see how they're trapped in a materialistic, deterministic system? So he's saying, look, you'd have to have something outside, something that wasn't part of that system. And he says, that's outside of my belief system. So he says true free will would require us to somehow step outside of our brain structure and modify how it works. Science hasn't shown any way we can do this because we are simply constructs of our brain. We can't impose a nebulous, quote, will on the inputs of our brain that can affect its output of decisions and actions any more than a programmed computer can somehow reach inside itself and change its program. The ineluctable scientific conclusion is that although we feel that we're characters in the play of our lives, rewriting our parts as we go along, in reality, we're puppets performing scripted parts written by the laws of physics. Now, Sam Harris, he's a neuroscientist. Sam Harris says in his 2012 book titled Free Will, free will is an illusion. Free will is an illusion. Our wills are simply not of our own making. Thoughts and intentions emerge from background causes of which we're unaware and over which we have no conscious control. We do not have the freedom we think we have. Then he says, you will do whatever it is you do, and it is meaningless to assert that you could have done otherwise. It's meaningless to assert you could have done otherwise. It's no wonder that he has described human beings, his words, he has described human beings as biochemical puppets. Biochemical puppets. Paul Bloom, who's a professor of psychology and cognitive science at Yale University, he wrote, our actions are in fact, now these are the elites, right? And this guy, professor of cognitive science, Yale University, everybody think, oh no, those guys have everything wired. They really know how life works. And he says, our actions are in fact literally predestined, determined by the laws of physics, the state of the universe, long before we were born, and perhaps by random events at the quantum level. We chose none of this. And so free will does not exist. Referring to Sam Harris's book, the physicist Victor Stenger, he wrote in 2012, we don't exist as immaterial conscious controllers, but are instead entirely physical beings whose decisions and behaviors are the fully caused products of the brain and body. Now, this leads naturally, right? This leads naturally to the claim that humans are not responsible for their actions. I mean, right? I mean, isn't that where you're going to go? You have to go there. If I'm a biochemical puppet, well, what are you talking about blaming me for something? I'm simply a robot. There is no personal culpability because there is no choice. I mean, the reason a person who is hurled from a cliff isn't condemned for landing on somebody is because physical laws, gravity, compelled him to fall. He had no choice in the matter. Well, if everything I do is the result of physical laws working, however complex they may be, well, then naturally, I'm not culpable for anything. I am a biochemical puppet. I'm no more culpable than the man who was thrown off the cliff. That is where you go. If you say, well, wait a minute, this thing of free will causes me a problem because I have no good explanation for how I get from everything that's dead. Now I have to a state where there are beings that are not controlled by that. How can that be? Well, that can't really be. So what's the answer? Well, that's an illusion. Okay, but you know unintended consequences, right? So now what happens? Now I say that's an illusion. Okay, well, if that's an illusion, then how can I be culpable for anything? The actions are not mine. They are all dictated and determined, and that's where that leads. And, I mean, this is no secret. You can think through this, right? You see that's where that leads? Well, let me show you some other people who recognize this, some of the atheists who recognize this. Tamler Summers. Tamler Summers, associate professor of philosophy at the University of Houston. Indignation, outrage, resentment, and hatred of criminals are everywhere. And all of these attitudes are grounded in an unjustifiable philosophical premise that people can be ultimately responsible for their actions. Why is it so difficult to abandon the deeply problematic concept of free will and ultimate moral responsibility? The decisive theoretical reasons for rejecting free will and moral responsibility fail to persuade us because we feel free, we feel responsible, and in acting like that's meaningless. Oh yeah, the fact you feel it, what does that count? That doesn't count anything. That's no kind of input. Your experience is irrelevant. I know you feel it. They say, oh, because we feel it. It goes, admittedly, the idea that criminals do not morally deserve punishment is tough to accept. But no more so than was the claim that the earth revolves around the sun. Dawkins, in 2006, in Edge magazine, I love this. Dawkins says, but doesn't a truly scientific, mechanistic view of the nervous system make nonsense of the very idea of responsibility, whether diminished or not? Any crime, however heinous, is in principle to be blamed on antecedent conditions acting through the accused's physiology, heredity, and environment. Don't judicial hearings to decide questions of blame or diminished responsibility make as little sense for a faulty man as for a faulty car? And I say here, a faulty car, that refers to a skit in the British television show Fawlty Towers. It's a comedy show in which the guy beats his car for not working properly. And so he gets all angry at it, and he's trying to, you know, whack on it and all this like it has a mind. And so Dawkins is saying, look, to punish people, doesn't that make as little sense for a faulty man as for a faulty car? And of course, I want to ask Dawkins, why do you call him faulty? But that'd be another question. He says, why is it that we humans find it almost impossible to accept such conclusions? Why do we vent such visceral hatred on child murderers or on thuggish vandals when we should simply regard them as faulty units that need fixing or replacing? Presumably because mental constructs like blame and responsibility, indeed evil and good, are built into our brains by millennia of Darwinian evolution. Assigning blame and responsibility is an aspect of the useful fiction of intentional agents that we construct in our brains as a mean of shortcutting a truer analysis of what's going on in the world in which we have to live. My dangerous idea is that we shall eventually grow out of all this and even learn to laugh at it, just as we laugh at Basil Fawlty when he beats his car. So he's saying, you know, my dangerous idea that we will, in our great illumination, we will transcend this juvenile idea that humans are morally responsible, despite the fact all of humanity's recognized it. Now here comes Dawkins. All of humanity's recognized the notion of human responsibility. But here he is, a Johnny come lately, a razor blade in the time. He's just saying, you know, my idea is what I do is that we will transcend that one day and we will laugh at the notion that human beings were held responsible for their conduct, just the way we laugh at that guy beating that car. But then he says, but I fear it is unlikely that I shall ever reach that level of enlightenment. I'm going to come back to that in a little bit. But that's Dawkins' take on the issue. Richard Dawkins. Now, Sam Harris, he wrote in his book, Free Will, we can no longer locate a plausible hook upon which to hang our conventional notions of personal responsibility. Do you see how that goes out the window? Once I say that, look, you're a biochemical puppet, well, of course, that's going out. So this is what Harris says. Bruce Waller, he's a professor of philosophy at Youngstown State University. He says in his book, Against Moral Responsibility, the basic claim of this book is that all the extraordinary and creative efforts of contemporary philosophers notwithstanding, moral responsibility cannot survive in our naturalistic scientific system. Moral responsibility was a comfortable fit among gods and miracles and mysteries, but the deeper scientific understanding of human behavior and the causes shaping human character leaves no room for moral responsibility. See, I want you to see, when I tell you these things, I give you all of these people, and if you go to the paper there, you'll see they're sourced. I can't put all that stuff here, but I give them to you so you see this is where I pull these things from. This isn't preacher talk, okay? This is stuff that is there, and you can see it and you can verify it, that this is the outcome. This is what people are saying. This is what people understand. Now, similarly, Stinger, he says in 2012, given that we don't have libertarian free will that sets us above causal laws, it would seem that our largely retributive moral and justice systems need to be reevaluated. and maybe even drastically revamped. Now, in that last sentence to the Dawkins quote that I read for you just a second ago, where he says, "But I fear it's unlikely that I shall ever reach." He said, "That's my dangerous idea. We'll eventually grow out of all this and even learn to laugh at it, just as we laugh at Basil Fawlty when he beats his car. But I fear it is unlikely that I shall ever reach that level of enlightenment." Now, you see, he knows, he acknowledges that he can't live consistently with the logical consequence of his position. He just says it. He sits there and says, "Yeah, that's my great idea. We'll transcend it. But I can't do that." He said, "What are we talking about? You're sitting there telling me that you've got things wired. You understand how things work. But then you turn around and tell me, but I can't live consistently with that." Isn't that an alarm bell? I mean, doesn't that tell you something? When he winds up saying it, he knows that he holds people responsible for their actions, despite the fact that his atheism gives him no basis for doing so. You know he holds people. If he was teaching a class and a kid rolled in and said, "Hey, I didn't do it," what do you think he'd say? "Well, what can I tell you? You weren't wired to do it." Do you think he'd do that? Or do you think he'd say F? I suspect he'd say F. And then you say, "Well, Dawkins, don't you realize that's inconsistent with everything you say?" And then what would he do? Jump out the window? I don't know. He'd probably just say, "Well, you're a moron. Go on." But now, so you have this. Dawkins says it. Nancy Piercy, she reported in her 2010 book, Saving Leonardo, that a young man asked Dawkins, he pressed Dawkins on this inconsistency at a book signing event. And I happen to know that the young man recorded the conversation. And so he presses Dawkins on this. And the young man says, here's Dawkins at a book signing, something he's written, you know, he's proud of it. He's, "Here I am, I'm doing books, come on in." He says, "If humans are machines, and it's inappropriate to blame or praise them for their actions, then should we be giving you credit for the book you're promoting?" And Dawkins says, "I can't bring myself to do that. I actually do respond in an emotional way, and I blame people. I give people credit." The young guy says, "But don't you see that as an inconsistency in your views?" "I sort of do, yes. But it's an inconsistency that we sort of have to live with. Otherwise, life would be intolerable." As I say, don't you think that's an alarm of some kind? Otherwise, life would be intolerable. And this inconsistency, this double talk, it is widely recognized and accepted. The MIT cognitive scientists, MIT, big time school. The MIT cognitive scientist, Marvin Minsky, he wrote in his book, The Society of Mind. He says, "Does this mean we must embrace the modern scientific view and put aside the ancient myth of voluntary choice?" No, we can't do that. Too much of what we think and do revolves around those old beliefs. Consider how our social lives depend upon the notion of responsibility and how little that idea would mean without our belief that personal actions are voluntary. No matter that the physical world provides no room for free will, we're virtually forced to maintain that belief, even though we know it's false. We're forced to maintain that belief, even though we know it's false. The British philosopher Galen Strawson was asked in an interview in March of 2003, if it's a fact that there's no free will, why do philosophers have such a hard time accepting that? And he says, "I think the impossibility of free will and ultimate moral responsibility can be proved with complete certainty." Now, this is this guy's take. It's 100%. "It's just that I can't really live with this fact from day to day." Can you really? As for the scientists, they may accept it in their white coats, but I'm sure they're just like the rest of us when they're out in the world, convinced of the reality of radical free will. And don't think that's a clue about anything. This idea, I can't function in the world this way. I have to live this way, that there is free will, there is moral responsibility. And don't draw from that anything about the truth of free will. They simply say, that's an odd feature, that I'm simply a biochemical puppet and a robot. And it is odd that I have this nagging thing that I can't live consistently with that. Rodney Brooks, he's the director of the Artificial Intelligence Lab at MIT, in his 2003 book, Flesh and Machines. He says, on the one hand, I believe myself and my children all to be mere machines, automatons at large in the universe. Every person I meet is also a machine, a big bag of skin full of biomolecules interacting according to describable and knowable rules. When I look at my children, I can, when I force myself, understand them in this way. I see that they are machines interacting with the world. But that's not how I treat them. I treat them in a very special way, and I interact with them on an entirely different level. They have my unconditional love, the furthest one might be able to get from rational analysis. I maintain two sets of inconsistent beliefs and act on each of them in different circumstances. I maintain two sets of inconsistent beliefs. Now, when you're doing philosophy or thinking about truth and reality, when you maintain two sets of inconsistent beliefs, something's wrong. Something's wrong. And yet, say, I can't open the door to this other thing, so I'm going to continue on that. Now, that's Brooks. So, Edward Slingerland, he says in his 2008 book, What Science Offers the Humanities, as neuroscientists, we might believe that the brain is a deterministic physical system like everything else in the universe, and recognize that the weight of empirical evidence suggests that free will is a cognitive illusion. Nonetheless, no cognitively undamaged human being can help acting like, and at some level, really feeling that he or she is free. Now, he says in his 2012 book, Creating Consilience, Integrating the Science and the Humanities, that though he's convinced intellectually his daughter is, quote, merely a complex robot carrying my genes into the next generation, he admits that, quote, at an important and ineradicable level, the idea is both bizarre and repugnant to me, end quote. Stephen Novella, he's a clinical neurologist at Yale University. He wrote in his blog just a few months ago in June of 2018. He says, even though I'm highly aware of what neuroscience has to say about the illusion of free will and decision making, I also recognize that we have to live our life as if we have free will. Now, as I've been saying, you see, the fact that the atheist can't live consistently with the implications of their view is an indication that atheism is false. It clashes with reality, and it requires doublethink. It requires the employment of a useful fiction to function in the real world. As Nancy Percy says of Slingerland's claims, she says, what can we say when someone urges us to adopt a view of humanity that he himself admits is bizarre and repugnant? There's a severe clash between what his Darwinian materialism is telling him and what his lived experience is telling him. Which one will he accept as true? And what I'm suggesting to you is to go with the idea that you are not a biochemical puppet. You see, that you do in fact have free will, and that you do in fact have moral responsibility, and then that's why you act that way. You act that way not because you act that way because it's true, and that's the idea. So when they say that, you know, they talk to you and they say, listen, there's absolutely no basis for you thinking no basis for you. I said, well, wait a minute. Wait a minute. There is this notion of free will as an example. There's this notion. It seems to me that that fits much more consistently with the idea of the existence of God than your atheistic idea, which has no room for it. And so I say, that's evidence. That's something that's reasonable. That's something that's rational. Now let me see how far I can get on my final contention. I'm excited because I didn't think I would get this far. Okay, but let me see. This is the last one. It's related. The final contention, which is related really to the claim about free will, as you'll see, but it's that it's more reasonable to believe human thinking and reasoning are not determined solely by physical processes, whether they're mechanical, chemical, electrical, physical process. Human thinking and reasoning are not determined solely by physical processes than to believe they are. And it's more reasonable to believe that such non-determined thinking and reasoning cannot exist without God than to believe it can. As you may have picked up from a number of the quotes that I've given to you, quotes of atheists, this problem of physical determinism, this problem, it goes deeper than simply a denial of free will regarding behavior. It's deeper than that. Everything. Uh-oh. What's happened? Is it going to fall on me? Everything's determined by physics. Everything's determined by physics, including one's thoughts and beliefs. It's not just free will and choice and moral response. Everything. Your thoughts and your beliefs are determined by physics. Indeed, how could it be otherwise in an atheistic, naturalistic view in which all of reality must be reducible to natural processes acting over time? Bertrand Russell, what was he talking about? How deep does it go? Is it only free will? No, it's not only free will. Man's hopes, and remember, Russell is the premier atheist philosopher of the 20th century. Man's hopes and fears, his loves and his beliefs, what he believes. His beliefs are but the outcome of accidental collocations of atoms. It's all just matter, physical law, working out. So it's deeper than that. Francis Crick, he asserts that one's joys, sorrows, memories, ambitions are no more than the behavior of nerve cells and associated molecules. The atheist philosopher Rosenberg says all the processes in the universe, from atomic to bodily to mental, are purely physical processes involving fermions and bosons interacting with one another. Right? So that's it. That's the puppet. That's the robot. This is all. It has to be that way. But you rarely get people who in everyday discourse will be that consistent and that honest to say, yes, that's how it is. Now, if that's true, If it were true that one's thoughts and beliefs are merely the product of physics and chemistry, if that's true, if they're merely the results of deterministic natural processes, it would be pointless, would it not, to seek to change another person's beliefs through argument or rational discourse? I mean, why would I be sitting here saying this to you? If you're simply a chemical robot who simply believes and thinks whatever the laws of chemistry or electromagnetism or whatever is going on in you, well, why would I even be doing this? It's pointless, right? I mean, there would be no point to changing because your beliefs would be set not by rational discourse, but by chemistry. That's what's determining it. The fact atheists then seek to persuade others that belief in God and belief in free will, for example, are false. They're out there trying to persuade you rationally and by argument that those things are false, and they take pride in what they write and what they say. Well, that's just another example of how they cannot live consistently with their position. There's a clash there. Their position is self-refuting. Here's what Rupert Sheldrake said. Now, Rupert Sheldrake is a Cambridge-trained biochemist, and he's a plant physiologist. And Rupert Sheldrake says, "But materialists cannot possibly be consistent. They believe that minds are nothing but the activity of brains, and the activity of brains can ultimately be completely explained in terms of physical and chemical causation together with blind chance. In other words, free will is an illusion. This must mean that the materialist belief system is self-refuting. If a materialist were consistent, he or she would have to believe that his or her own beliefs were caused by brain activity alone. Materialist brains make them believe in materialism. Do you think they feel that way? Do you think that when they sniff at you as a believer, do you think they're not condescending and they think that, listen, I am superior to you because I have greater reasoning power? You say, but I thought it was all just electrical junk and chemical junk going on, so where's this pride coming from? You're a robot. That's all. You're a robot. So you perked up this way and you did so. I did this way. So he goes on, he says, materialist brains make them believe in materialism. But then how can they try to persuade others to adopt this belief on the basis of science, reason, and evidence if no one has free choice? By their own account, materialists cannot have adopted their materialist belief system by rational choice. Their brains make them believe it. And they cannot persuade others to believe it by science and reason. They can only pass on an infection. And yet they don't, you see, this is how, you see how they act. You see what they're doing, how they wind up arguing. Now, in addition to having no basis for seeking to change other people's beliefs through argument and rational discourse, the atheist has no basis for thinking that any particular beliefs are true. Has no basis for thinking that any particular beliefs are true. I mean, after all, if thoughts and beliefs, if they are merely chemical or electrical processes, if they are brain secretions, okay? If they're merely chemical or electrical processes, brain secretions that have been selected and shaped through evolutionary history for their ability to enhance survival and reproduction, there's no reason to trust that those beliefs correspond to reality. There's no reason to think that. As Eric Baum says in his book, What is Thought? Published by MIT Press, sometimes you're more likely to survive and propagate if you believe a falsehood than if you believe the truth. That's certainly true. That's correct. Harvard psychologist Steven Pinker, he likewise acknowledged in his book How the Mind Works. He says our brains were shaped for fitness, not for truth. Sometimes the truth is adaptive, but sometimes it's not. You think, well, how can that work out? Well, for example, believing that getting near a lion will turn you into a stone. Having that belief, well, that will enhance survival, right? It'll keep you away from lions. But it's false. It will enhance survival despite being false. And believing that practicing birth control will cause you to be struck by lightning, well, that will enhance reproduction despite being false. Right? I mean, one can imagine countless false beliefs that would have a selective advantage. There could be countless false beliefs that would enhance survival and reproduction. So this idea that somehow that they'd have to be true, well, that's not correct. Now, even if you assume for the sake of argument that true beliefs that correspond to reality, that they're more likely to enhance survival and reproduction, and thus that evolution disproportionately favors the development of true beliefs, ample room remains for selectively advantageous false beliefs, as I just illustrated. The idea of getting near a lion, you'll turn to a stone, using birth control. You can think of many others. But beyond that, there are an unlimited number of false beliefs about abstract matters of philosophy, theology, history, science, mathematics, that wouldn't affect behavior, or they would affect it in ways that are irrelevant to survival and reproduction. For example, one's belief about that an actual infinite can exist. Or one's belief that stars are giant balls of gas. Well, that wouldn't alter one's behavior. That wouldn't change your behavior so as to make one more or less likely to reproduce. There's a universe of these kinds of things. You see, those kinds of beliefs, they are detached from survival and procreation. They are invisible to natural selection, and thus they wouldn't even have that weak constraint from deviating from truth. I hope you're following me on this. You see, because I'm saying to you that, look, even if you assume that there is some constraint on deviating from truth because of selective advantage, I've shown that there are many things that would have a selective advantage that are false, but I'm saying even if you grant that there is some, there would be a preponderance, or there is something that would, natural selection would favor correspondence of your beliefs with the reality, I want you to see that there are a universe of beliefs that have nothing, that are blind to natural selection. They don't affect how you act, you see? And so natural selection will have nothing to do with them. I mean, after all, atheists insist. They're the ones who insist that evolution has produced within the human population an overwhelming number of human brains that believe falsely in the existence of objective morality, in the existence of free will, in the existence of spiritual beings. And we're assured that these particular beliefs are illusions, fobbed off on us by our genes, things we're programmed to believe are true, and programmed to believe that we have adequate grounds for believing they're true, but they're all actually false. So I said, wait a minute. So you recognize then, right, through your evolutionary process, that all kinds of beliefs come through and are false. Okay? So what I want you to see, if what you're saying about this is true, you have no reason to believe that anything you're hanging on to is true. You know, if that's the case, who's to say that any belief, including atheism and belief in naturalistic evolution, who's to say that's not a false belief fobbed off on us by our genes? We can have no reason to be confident that any of our beliefs are true. You see, once reason is denied any independence from natural processes, once you say that thinking and reasoning are purely naturalistic processes, that you are simply a biochemical puppet and a robot, the entire edifice crashes. See, naturalism ends up committing intellectual suicide. Now, what I'm claiming here, it's certainly not new, and it's not original with me. I had somebody ask me after one of the classes, well, what are people on the other side? I said, look, nothing I'm telling you is original. You just go look. You know, people say things. I try to deal with the things that I think you'd run into right off the bat. But go look around. But here, what I'm saying, it's not new. Darwin himself saw and alluded to the very problem I'm trying to articulate. He saw and alluded to this problem in a letter that dated July 3, 1881, to the philosopher and political economist named William Graham. After admitting that he shared Graham's intuition, Darwin says he shares Graham's intuition that the universe is not the result of chance. Now, having said that, he then attempts to undercut the significance of his own inward conviction on the matter by declaring famously, "But then with me the horrid doubt always arises whether the convictions of man's mind, which has been developed from the mind of lower animals, are of any value or at all trustworthy." Would anyone trust the convictions of a monkey's mind if there are any convictions in such a mind? Do you see what he's getting at? It's this thing I'm trying to tell you. J.B.S. Haldane, he was a famous geneticist, British geneticist, and evolutionary biologist. J.B.S. Haldane wrote in 1927, "It seems to me immensely unlikely that mind is a mere byproduct of matter. For if my mental processes are determined wholly by the motions of atoms in my brain, I have no reason to suppose that my beliefs are true. They may be sound chemically, but that doesn't make them sound logically. In order to escape from this necessity of sawing away the branch on which I'm sitting, so to speak, I'm compelled to believe that mind is not wholly conditioned on matter." Now, Alvin Plantinga, I've mentioned him. Alvin Plantinga is a world-class Christian philosopher. And Plantinga, he published a central thesis of his 2011 book, Where the Conflict Really Lies, is that those who believe humans evolved through purely naturalistic process, a naturalistic evolutionary process, they have no reason to trust the reliability of their cognitive faculties, to trust that their beliefs correspond to truth. Now, I'm over time, but let me put a bow on this and then I'll shut up. Okay, imagine you find an electronic device. You find an electronic device that displays numbers, and it has a keyboard of numbers and symbols. Okay, so it displays numbers and it has a keyboard of numbers and symbols. And you learn that this device was pieced together over time based solely on how each addition enhanced the device's attractiveness to infants. Okay, you with me? So we find this device, you learn that it was developed over time based solely on how each addition enhanced the device's attractiveness to infants. Now, in that case, you would have no reason to believe that the device would function as a calculator. You would have no reason to believe, no reason to trust that it would produce accurate mathematical computations. You'd have no reason to believe that because its development was directed by a criterion unrelated to mathematical computation. And that's what I want you to see. The evolutionary process is unrelated to truth. It is related only to survival and reproduction. So that's important. Well, if our brain developed gradually over time based solely on how each addition enhanced the ability to survive and reproduce, we have no reason to believe it would function as a generator of true beliefs. No reason to trust that it would produce beliefs that conform to reality. We'd have no reason to believe that because its development, as I say, was driven by a criterion unrelated or marginally related at best to the generation of true beliefs. All right, overtime, conclusion. Nope, conclusion, that's it. I want you to see just this idea that the last point I have here is that free will, I'm convinced it's more reasonable to believe that free will exists than to deny it, and it's more reasonable to believe that free will cannot exist without God than to think it can. So when I hear these people lecture me and scold me and talk down to me, I'm not a fan of it, okay? Just frankly, not a fan of it. Thanks for coming.